Many U.S. veterans from past wars returned home after serving their country with little in the way of thanks or appreciation. This hour, a program that aims to set that right, the Eastern Iowa Honor Flight. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This Veterans Day, we take you along for a day trip to our nation's capital with over 80 Iowa veterans of World War II and the Korean War.
We started out quiet in the morning, and then during the course of the day, you hear them swapping stories. So this is a tremendous living, rolling history lesson.
You'll hear emotional moments, sounds from a ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, as well as more lighthearted stories. Come aboard for an Eastern Iowa Honor Flight after this news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. And this hour, we have a special presentation for you. Stories from Iowa veterans.
You could be on guard and sit there and see the enemy across the barbed wire fences.
Terrible mess. Bodies laying all over, especially Germans that they hadn't picked up.
I think about the guys that didn't come back.
And I think those of us that are left over were just so glad we were alive, we didn't want to think about it. So we didn't for a long time.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today we're going to be flying from eastern Iowa to Washington, D.C. as part of an Eastern Iowa Honor Flight. It's just past 5 in the morning, October 16th, 2013. Right now, I'm standing in the lobby of the Eastern Iowa Airport, and as you can hear, there are a number of people here already. Veterans, 82 veterans, mainly from two wars, the Korean War and from World War II, all eagerly anticipating a flight, which will take place shortly. Leave from the Eastern Iowa Airport, a direct flight to Washington, D.C., to visit the war memorials and a number of other places. Before we get on board, let's chat with a few of the veterans to find out what's on their minds.
I'm Don Pospischel from Cedar Rapids, and I was in the Air Force Korean War in the 50s.
How often do you get together with a group of this large of a group of Korean War veterans? Does that happen very often?
No. Most Korean didn't even want to mention they were over there. When you came back, where were you?
Really?
Nobody even cared.
Nobody cared?
Not during Korea.
Okay, I'm Clyde Deal. I live in Hiawatha. I served in Korea during the Korean War. I was in the Army, and we spent most of our time up on the mountain with radio relay, establishing communications between the different headquarters companies. Oh, the most thing that stands out in my mind was the scares we had there from guerrillas that were pretty thick in the country.
I'm Vern E. Eschen. I'm Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I served in the Korean War.
And tell us, what were your days like in Korea? Where did you serve?
I served in up there the main line.
What were your duties? What was your day like?
I infantry.
What was, do you remember an early experience that you had as an infantryman in Korea that told you this is what war is all about?
Oh, yeah, we kept running out of ammo.
Running out of ammo?
Yeah, sure did. Just hoping you'd get out of there and have more backup coming or something. He was outnumbered bad. Ran out of ammo, boy, he's in trouble.
Most of the veterans are accompanied by guardians. Someone who will stay with them the whole day to help in a variety of ways. In some cases, veterans have difficulty physically getting around. And anyone might start getting tired on this 18-hour day that's planned, involving a flight out and back in the same day. Katha Ricciardi is one of the guardians. She's sitting next to her father, Robert Formanak, a World War II veteran.
My dad, he's at the care center in Keystone. Dad has some mobility issues, and so there was some question whether this was really the right thing to do. But the more I talked to the nurse, Tammy, and Mandy, who was organizing, they said, you need to make the decision for yourself, but we will do whatever it takes.
Formanac is originally from Illinois and later moved to Cedar Rapids.
I was stationed with the Air Force Training Command in Georgia for 4 years. I was assigned to that because I was working on my master's degree at the University of Iowa.
He was a trainer, training the pilots.
Physical education.
For them to be physically fit and able to...
They were young guys that were still in going to school.
Mr. Formanac, what are you looking forward to while going to visit the World War II Memorial, other memorials? What are you looking most forward to?
Seeing the other soldiers. Meeting old friends.
Meeting up with some old friends possibly here. Yeah, Who knows?
What are your thoughts when you have this sort of special event for you happen?
It's unbelievable. That's what it is.
Now at the gate, the veterans, the guardians, and the volunteers walk out onto the tarmac and board a charter plane for the direct flight to Washington, D.C. After just over 90 minutes, we're 800 miles away in our nation's capital. And as the vets start down the jetway toward the open door, they hear the sound of applause and music.
Welcome to D.C. Thank you for your service, sir. You have a great day in your memorial.
About 50, 70 people here. A man you hear on a French horn playing old American tunes. And the veterans noticeably moved as they are welcome. Big smiles on some of their faces. Other faces, you can see they're trying to contain their emotions.
You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're bringing you the stories, sounds, and a little of the music of a recent Eastern Iowa honor flight, which offered a free trip to Washington, D.C. for over 80 Iowa veterans on October 16th of 2013. At this point in the trip, we get on charter buses.
We're all in the buses and ready to head off to the first stop, which is the World War II Memorial.
The memorial is a large oval ring of pillars, and in the middle is a fountain. The fountain is turned off because this day was still during a partial government shutdown.
Due to the shutdown, there's a notice as we walk under the column to enter the memorial, and I'll just read it to you. Due to the federal government shutdown, this National Park Service Area is closed except for First Amendment activities. Let's walk in through and see if we have any problem getting into the memorial. Hello, sir. We're with Iowa Public Radio. We're here with a group of veterans from Iowa. Mm-hmm. We saw your sign out here. Is there any problem for veterans coming in to see the memorial today?
Not at all.
Not at all.
That's where they are, right there.
Okay, very good. Mm-hmm. Has there been problems in the last few days?
Not at all.
Not at all. Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Thank you. Why is there a sign then if it's open as usual?
Read that. The memorial is closed.
The memorial is closed.
But read the sign.
I did read the sign.
So they have their First Amendment activity. That's why they're here.
Okay. So the veterans are viewed, their activity is a First Amendment activity.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir. Mm-hmm.
Veterans are starting to explore the area.
Everett Kubik from Lisbon, Iowa.
We don't have our fountains going today because of the shutdown.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
No, I would like getting into it, but I don't want to get into politics. I don't argue politics and religion. What do you think?
Other veterans have a similar answer to that question, and even the few who do express an opinion don't seem to have politics in the forefront of their mind during this day. Instead, they're opening up with more stories of their experiences. Kubik was in World War II and then also served in the Korean War.
In July, I went for a physical, and in August, I went in a draft.
What year is this?
1945.
1945, so toward the end of the war.
Yes.
Oh, what does it mean to come to Washington, D.C. to visit the war memorials?
Well, to me, when I got home from service, nobody came to see me, and if they did, you know I was home or nothing. And this made me feel real good.
No recognition when you came home?
Nope.
From Korea or from World War II?
Yep.
Really?
Nope. I don't remember nothing. I was out on the farm.
Well, I want to thank you very much for chatting with us, okay. Mr. Kubik.
Yes.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you very much.
Hillis Kenny.
Hillis Kenny, tell us where you're from.
Animals, Iowa.
I see that you're a Korea War veteran. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your service there. Where were you?
Well, I was in Korea, and when I first went over, it was right when the war ended. Then I went up on the DMZ for about 3 months.
What was that like? Tense at that time.
It's scary.
What was scary about it?
You could be on guard and sit there and see the enemy across the barbed wire fences at a fire, like a bonfire or stuff, moving around. And, you know, they're going to bring a gun out or what's going to go on here? And never did, luckily. But I learned one thing while I was in the service. When I first went in, people always told me, don't volunteer for anything. So we were picking up rocks and carrying stuff. And when we fell out at noon, where they said, we would like volunteers that want to go to school to get a GI driver's license. Somebody beside me says, that's pushing a wheelbarrow.
Well, we pushing a what?
Wheelbarrow.
Uh-huh.
We were carrying rocks. I thought, well, pushing a wheelbarrow is better than carrying them.
Yes.
I went to school for 3 days, got a government driver's license, and then I drove the ambulance for all during basic training, like when we had on the rifle range or anything like that. I sat in the ambulance with the lieutenant, and the rest of them were out in the weather. It was cold down there in December.
So your lesson learned is don't always listen to people telling
you,
don't volunteer.
Do what you think is best.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to wait for somebody else's decision to act upon you.
As I circle around the memorial, another veteran is standing near a wall of stars representing those who were killed in the war.
Hello, Mr. Foster. My name is Ben Kiefer. I'm with the Iowa Public...
Foster Cass?
Oh, Cass is your name. What is the Foster there for?
Middle.
I'll tell you
what happened.
Mr. Cass, I'm sorry.
I'm William Foster Cass on my birth certificate. They found that when I went in the Navy in 1941.
Yeah.
The family always called me Foster.
I see.
So when I got in the Navy, then I'm William and Bill after that. I'd never seen the ocean before, and I get on this ship and there aren't enough officers. I had to take a top watch. And here I am, never saw the ocean before.
A boy from Iowa.
Yeah, a boy. Yes, I caught on pretty fast. In the next 4 trips, I was all by myself as an officer of the deck, Iowa boy.
What did you see in Africa? What is the strongest memory that you have of the fighting there?
I didn't see much fighting. We did have submarines getting over there. But we got in the dock at Safi. There was still some resistance. The planes came down to bomb our ship. But they hit an Amtrak on the dock and blew it up and killed some soldiers. But we fired away at the thing, and later I read where we got credit for shooting it down, but I don't know.
You were not only in Africa in that invasion, but you served in other places?
Oh, yes.
Where else did you serve?
Well, after the first 5 trips, the Army took my ship over and decommissioned it. So I was put on, believe it or not, the USS Fayette. And that's where I came from. And I was, that's an attack transport. Well, that's when things got hot, and over there we were invading the islands.
Okay, you were in the...
Tarawa, Kwajalein, and Enewetok. Our ship would take the guys that I really respect and feel for, the ones that had to get off the ship, down those nets, into the landing boats and go in and face the fire on the shore. I didn't have to. We had relative safety on the ship. Maybe a kamikaze, or maybe a submarine might be around with a torpedo. But we were outside the shore guns. They couldn't hit us. So we were relatively safe compared to those guys that went over the side. The Marines or Army are the ones I have a lot of respect for.
What for you is the best part of this day?
Well, it's just getting started, but seen so many old guys. I'm only 94.
You're 94.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you could be that Iowa boy out in the ocean?
No, I couldn't do that. I don't see well enough. I don't hear well enough. I couldn't do that again. I'd try.
How does serving your country this way during war change you?
I think more the last few years. I think I shut it out for a lot of years. I didn't want to think about it, but a few years ago I wrote my memoirs, And the second chapter is just about all about the war. But I found out I could think about it and remember. I just shut it out. And that's what a lot of vets do.
What? Why?
You don't want to remember those things. With so many veterans, their bad experiences, they shut them out at the time. They don't want to remember. But later in life, they find out they can remember and talk about them.
Bill Cassie, you said you're 94 years old. You served in World War II. You went into the Navy before Pearl Harbor, served for many years in several theaters in World War II in the Navy. We're standing here at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., right before a part of the memorial where in granite it says, "Here we mark the price of freedom." There are untold number of stars on the yes. wall here. Each of these stars, I think, represents 100 Americans
Isn't
who
that
died.
Hard to imagine?
Tell me your thoughts. That when you look at all these stars.
Yeah, you can't imagine that 100 for every one of those. Those are the guys. They're killed. They had no future. And I think those of us that are left over were just so glad we were alive, we didn't even want to think about it. So we didn't for a long time. And then later years, you begin to see that you better talk about it. They won't know what that means.
They won't know what "here we mark freedom. The price of freedom."
They won't know what freedom means or what we paid for it if we don't tell them.
Mr. Cass, thank you for this conversation, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you for your service to our country.
Well, I appreciate you guys that are thinking about it.
The group gets back on the coach buses for a short drive west toward the Potomac, very near the Lincoln Memorial. Here we stop to see the Veterans Memorial for the war that most of these Iowans were involved in, the Korean War.
Name is Les Tharp. I'm from Grinnell, Iowa.
We're standing here in the Korean War Memorial. So tell me, describe a little bit about what we're seeing. What do you see in front of us? We have soldiers there.
They're going down, usually. They're going up a mountain or down a mountain looking for enemy. And they kind of spread out a little more than this, but it's pretty impressive. It does bring back memories.
So you've seen that scene in real life, the troops going off on patrol in the ponchos, a lot of rain in Korea.
Oh, yeah. In the springtime, there's a lot of rain.
Is this, Lester, an emotional moment for you to be here? What are you feeling?
Well, yes. Very emotional.
Can you tell us what's behind those emotions, what thoughts you're having, what images you have from your time?
Well, I think about the guys that didn't come back. I mean, there is quite a few of them, so it's hard to describe.
You're a veteran of a war that's often called the Forgotten War. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that title?
It wasn't forgotten by the people that were there.
What kind of reception, what kind of acknowledgement did you get upon returning as a returning soldier?
Nothing. We docked in San Francisco at a warehouse that was there and walked through the warehouse, changed, took everything off, got new uniforms and stuff, and no reception. When I got out, I decided that I better get something done and get my education, get on with it.
Right. So. Lester Tharp, thank you very much for your service, sir, and for talking with us today.
Thank you.
A short distance away, a few more World War II veterans are near the Lincoln Memorial.
My name is Mance King, and I live in Des Moines at this point. I'm originally from the West Coast. I did my combat duty in Europe over Germany.
Mm-hmm. You're in the Air Force?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What was your part in the Air Force?
I was a pilot.
A bomber pilot?
Yes.
How many missions did you fly on?
23, I believe.
Can you tell me about a mission that stands out in your mind today?
It was my very first mission. And I took an 88-millimeter anti-aircraft shell right in the nose section, and it just ruined everything. It made 37 holes from the inside out and crippled our landing gear. Well, we didn't have any flaps. We didn't have any hydraulics. That was the problem.
What type of plane is this?
This was a B-24, a four-engine bomber. Heavy bomber. we had to leave the formation, and we had the my navigator directed us to a an emergency RAF field. It was 500 feet wide and 10,000 feet long, and we used all but about 50 feet of it. We hit pretty hard, and we coasted within from here to those trees over there at the end of the runway. And we were very happy to get out. By the time that airplane stopped moving, I don't think there was a man left in it. We jumped out. I mean, we were on the ground by then. And the RAF took us in and gave us a medical exam and about that much Jamaican rum in a glass, which was very nice.
When you went out on a mission, did you believe I very probably won't be coming back?
Oh, yeah, you think that. You told that to all the girls, too.
With what effect?
Buried.
Yeah. How did that change you, Mance, King? When you think of the young man you were going in before you were a pilot and bomber pilot with all the experiences that you've been describing, How did it change you?
It was a momentous change, believe me. You know, I'd never even been inside an airplane. I came right off the farm and went into the Air Force and ended up as a pilot.
Did you ask yourself, because bomber crews, you know, a lot of them didn't survive, did you ask yourself why you were a lucky one?
Every day.
Every day. A lot of good men lost.
Why me? Why me? You know. Oh, yeah. And, you know, there's 10 men on every bomber, heavy bomber, and you lose 10 aircraft, you've got 60 men, young men that haven't had a chance to live yet. Gone. Bad. War has so many aspects to it. It's a terrible thing, and yet there are very comical moments in it. It just crack you up, you know.
Comical?
Absolutely comical.
What would be a comical moment? You can remember?
Well, the time we bailed out, my navigator landed in a tree, a big oak tree, in the middle of a women's Air Force camp, and he was swinging back and forth in his parachute, and all these gals come running out of the barracks, you know, and they say, "Oh, may I feel your petticoat?" You know. Old Shea was up there just grinning like a chessy cat, just swinging back and forth.
As you can hear, in Washington, even though we have a partial shutdown, there's a lot of air activity. And now we get back on the bus and cross the Potomac into Virginia. And this next stop is remarkably much more quiet. Arlington National Cemetery. We're going to take a break now on the program, but stay with us. In the next half hour of the show, we'll bring you the sounds of Iowans in a wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And we'll hear more stories.
We got strafed about 10 o'clock one Sunday morning by two North Korean MiGs.
Guys that was near him told me what happened, what a mess they left him in on. There wasn't much left of his body, so what was the matter.
Sounds and stories from a recent Eastern Iowa honor flight to Washington, D.C., on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we return to our special show highlighting sounds and stories from a recent Eastern Iowa honor flight to Washington, D.C. Still ahead, some emotional moments.
That morning that I got hit, we lost 10 truck drivers, 10 personnel, and there was 13 wounded.
As we left off, we heard from veterans at the Korean War Veterans Memorial. That's the war that most of the over 80 veterans on this trip served in. And now, we're at Arlington National Cemetery. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there is a solitary soldier here standing guard at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. He's right before me, and it's a very interesting and moving, even though it's done in complete silence, We have several hundred people watching this soldier doing his guard duty according to very precise measurements, all having to do with 21, matching up with the highest military honor of a 21-gun salute. Marches in one direction, 21 steps exactly. He stops for 21 seconds. He pauses. He turns and pauses again 21 seconds before going back in the same direction, 21 steps, and it continues on and on. Let's listen. You can hear the loud clicking of heels during this ceremony. That's from specialized handmade metal additions to the tomb guard's shoes. It's one of several parts of the full dress uniform that tomb guards make themselves. Their uniform also indicates no rank on it, so they do not appear to outrank any of the soldiers buried here. After the very formal and precise changing of the guard ceremony, there's another ceremony. Four of the Iowa veterans will join the tomb guards to lay a wreath at the tomb. The entire audience is asked to remain standing, silent, and then salute or hold a hand over their heart. The veterans then hand the wreath to the guard, who places it next to the tomb.
Bill Wood from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
What were you thinking of when that ceremony was taking place and then Taps was played? What's going through your mind?
Oh, bring back remembering them guys that I lost, them two guys that I lost, especially the one who was such a close friend of mine.
And we're back at the entrance of Arlington National Cemetery now. Where did you serve during World War II?
In Europe.
In Europe?
Started in England, moved into France, Belgium, Luxembourg, and Germany.
So when did you come in after D-Day?
A month and a half after D-Day, we went in on the beaches were still there. The only thing that wasn't, we didn't have to worry about, was the gun emplacements, the German gun emplacements. They called them pillboxes. They were there, but they'd done away with the Germans. They cleaned them out. So.
What beach did you come in on?
Utah.
Utah. Mm-hmm. What was it like coming in on Utah Boy at that point?
One thing about it, it went down there and outlined where they were mine. Everything was mine. They had it all mine so that you didn't step on one of them landmines, see. And other than that, got wet. It would come from England over there and what they call LCI, Landing Craft Infantry. They dropped the gangbank and you wade in, go ashore that way.
So you got up there, and then you proceeded across France.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Kind of took a zigzag course. Like I say, what happened, we were 7th Army, and then Patton come along and took us over in the 3rd Army, and we was all under the jurisdiction of Patton's 3rd Army then.
I heard that a lot of the troops, the hedgerows were a problem. Was that a problem when you were there?
Yes.
These are these tall, tall hedgerows that are separating the fields there.
There were two kinds of hedgerows. Some was natural. In other words, it was growth of bushes, and a lot of it was man-made, you know, is what it was. And the man-made, they just walked right to it with them big tanks and dozer tanks, knocked them down. Where the hedgerows, they just drove right over them if it was bushes, you know.
When you were up moving along, making progress, what's a day that stands out for you? What's an event, a day that stands out, perhaps a day when you thought...
Just a terrible mess, bodies laying all over, especially Germans that they hadn't picked up, and bad, not a good sight at all, nothing. You know, that's the only bad thing. Like I told the French people that I was talking to, explaining to get their history books out and they'll see what we were done, how we moved in there and made the path, widened it out, that's all. That's it. Yeah. And they started burying them Germans, right? They'd have mass graves, and our people, it was pretty well picked up as they got knocked down and killed. They picked them up, but they left the Germans laying there. Couldn't move too fast.
Do you recall the name of your friend you lost?
Just the one guy. The other guy, I couldn't remember his last name, that Bob. Mm-hmm. But the other guy was Howard Allen, I remember him. He's a little bit older than me, and he always kind of treated me like a brother.
He did?
Yeah, he did. He's just that kind of guy, you know. When he talked to me, he's talking like talking to a brother, not just another soldier, you know. He's a sergeant, and I was a private first class. He's superior to me, see. But that didn't, he never let that interfere with friendship. You know. What happened, they separated us. Detached service, they moved us around a lot. And that's when I got separated from him, that's when I found out he got killed, you know. Otherwise, I wasn't around him when he got killed, so.
Did you find out what happened to him?
I found out what happened, yeah. The guys that was near him told me what happened, what a mess they left him in, you know. And yeah, there wasn't much left of his body, is what was the matter. So what'd they do? They dedicated a bridge over there to him. They thought that much of that man. They dedicated a small road bridge, the Howard Allen Bridge.
So going across Europe, how did combat end? How did World War II end for you?
Well, Frankfurt, that was the end. In fact, the combat, frontline combat troops was way ahead of us by then. Frankfurt, as far as we went.
Yeah.
That was a big city. That was New York. That's what New York City, Frankfurt. But it was a mess. It wasn't a, them large building was all gutted. They dropped them incendiary bombs and burned them right to the ground if they didn't blow them up.
Want to see the Billy Wood that left Iowa to go fight for his country, yeah, in Europe. How was that Billy Wood who left different one than the one who came back after the war?
I don't know. I'm trying to forget about stuff, you know.
How did it change you?
Made you look a little bit different at the world. Now here we are in this mess we're in today, and I feel for these young guys today. This automation, look what you got, computer, everything computerized, something I know nothing about. We never knew anything about that. Everything we done was manual.
Mr. Wood, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. I'm so grateful for your service to our country. I want to thank you again.
Thank you for doing that.
And for sharing your thoughts. That's really important that people hear what you have to say. Again, you're listening to River on Iowa Public Radio. We're along with a recent Eastern Iowa honor flight, bringing you thoughts and stories from some of the more than 80 Iowa veterans on this day trip to Washington, D.C.
I'm Gasper Miner, and I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Mm-hmm. You're a veteran of what war?
I'm a Korean War veteran. I was down in, we landed in Busan, and we went north to Daegu, and we set up our guns there, and then the Koreans were making a push to the west, coming down to cut us off at Busan, so we moved over to a little town by the name of Hanman, Korea, and that's where I was wounded. I was wounded in Hanman, Korea.
Were you infantry?
I was known 4.2 mortar.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the 25th Division, and there was 32nd. We were in 32nd heavy mortars. I was a more or less an ammo bearer. We had one gunner, and then we had seven ammo barrels. The sports have had seven ammo barrels, but we had five because they'd taken two and took to 24th Division to make that a full regiment when they sent it in Korea.
Yeah.
So we were understaffed, and we were pretty much. On our own, they were pretty heavy. They were 60, those projectiles weighed 65 pounds. And we used a lot of white phosphorus. That's what the North Koreans, they didn't like, because that stuff was like a mushroom. It would just mushroom in the air, and wherever it landed on you, it would start to burn. And the only way that you could put it out was to smother it with mud or a rag to keep the air from it.
Did you get attacked in your mortar position?
Yes. We got strafed about 10 o'clock one Sunday morning by two North Korean MiGs. And them guys were shooting with 50 caliber machine guns. And they strafed us one Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm. And did you take any casualties?
We had, three casualties and four wounded. Mm-hmm. Some of our guns were hit. Some of our mortars were hit.
What's a day you recall as perhaps the most challenging when you were in the Korean War?
I'd say the day I got hit.
Mm-hmm. You got wounded.
Yep.
Tell us about that.
The North Koreans were trying to cut us off at Pusan, and they had us surrounded, more or less. We were in this little area, with a road down by the south to us, and there was a little bank, a little hill to the northwest, and those Koreans, they were coming down the road, and I thought they were our guys. I thought they were our own riflemen, but pretty soon somebody shot at them. They just fell in the ditch like they were flies. They were North Koreans. They weren't our men. They were North Koreans, and they had us surrounded. Up on the, I got hit at 6 o'clock in the morning. It was foggy, and I looked to the north, and I could see guys walking around the ridge.
You said you got hit at 6 o'clock in the morning. What was the moment like before you got hit? What was happening at that moment?
You could hear firefights all during the night. You could hear small arms firefights, carbines. North Koreans used a lot of automatic weapons. We could hear these firefights, and we knew that they weren't friendly. So we went back. Captain told us that we could stay in the base all night. Next morning, we were surrounded. They had us cut off.
Did you think that was it for you?
I thought it was, yes. Because I got hit in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning. I didn't get picked up at 11 o'clock in the morning.
So you laid where?
And on the battlefield, right there on the field. This leg was broke. I was shot here, and it just rolled over this leg here. And I had a pair of combat boots on, and I took this finger, and I reached down in this here and dragged this leg about 40 yards to a kid from by Des Moines. And we lay there until the rifle guys finally picked us up. Medics picked us up about 11 o'clock in the morning.
So a medic did get to you?
Yes, yes.
But after several hours?
Yeah.
What was going through your mind when you were laying there?
Well, I thought I was going to bleed to death. Because this leg was shot, and I thought I was going to bleed to death. But I didn't. I guess they said later on that a bullet stops all wounds, all blood. And I had a pair of fatigues on, and it was by the time they picked me up at 11 o'clock, it was just starting to drip through here. It was just starting to drip through.
But you made it.
Yeah, they took, I and his kid from Des Moines and put us on the hood of a Jeep. And then they put, that morning that I got hit, we lost 10 truck drivers, 10 truck, there was 10 personnel, and there was 13 wounded the morning that I got hit.
You thought you'd never see Iowa again.
Yes. I was 20 years old. Yep.
How does such an experience change you? How did it?
Told me how to survive. Told me how to I could surely survive 5 hours of, laying on the ground, I guess.
Well, Gaspar Miner, I want to thank you for sharing with some memories that are not easy to share.
Yep.
And I want to thank you for your service, sir.
We're rough.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I'm glad you enjoyed your day.
Yep, I did. I really, it's a once in a lifetime. I'll never see it. I'm 83 years old, so I'll probably never see it again.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. It's about 5 o'clock, Washington, D.C. time, and we've left Arlington Cemetery and very quickly went through rush hour traffic to the Iwo Jima Memorial, this huge statue of... The very famous picture that was taken of men raising a flag on that Japanese island after that famous battle. And we've been moving from site to site very quickly with the help of the police here. We have a police escort the entire day. We're just told that this was the very first time that the Eastern Iowa Honor Flight was given a police escort. Really makes a difference in terms of going from site to site, saving time. It's impressive to see, too. We have three coach buses and surrounding us, police cars stopping all traffic. It's making quite an impression on the veterans here. Also another sign of, have to say, respect for the veterans, the guardians, the family members that are here. Only accolades as far as how they're being treated on this Eastern Iowa Honor Flight. I know the veterans and have been just delighted that They have a police escort through the city today. It's really speeded things up. And could I have your name, please?
Chuck Terrio.
You look like you might be responsible for that, U.S. Capitol police officer.
Right. I'm retired.
Uh-huh.
And we do it to spend our time to help you guys get around. Because if you didn't have escort, you'd all get broken up. And we know it takes a while for the vets to get on or off buses. And it would take you three times as long to see things. You'd probably not get past the half of them. So this way, you can get through city a little quicker.
Yeah. But I think it connects in more than just a practical way. The vets that I've talked to are just amazed that they get to be treated and thanked this way with an escort.
I'm a vet myself, so I know how I'd like to be treated, and I'm more than happy to treat these gentlemen that way. They went through a lot. That's all we need is a small token of our appreciation.
I want to thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for honoring our veterans.
My name is George Rickey. I'm the public relations and media coordinator for Eastern Iowa Honor Flight.
How would you characterize this group?
This is a typical Honor Flight group. It's kind of interesting because we started out quiet in the morning, and then during the course of the day, you hear them swapping stories. So, such a tremendous living, rolling history lesson.
You got involved with this, George Rickey, how many years ago?
About 2.5. And just, I was on my way to Orlando, flying out of Moline, and I happened to see an Honor Flight going out of there, and I just followed up, investigated, and fell in love with it.
What is the satisfaction you get from it?
It's just watching these guys who nobody ever thanked, then this is their thanks. We're at the Marine Corps Memorial right now, Ben. The last Honor Flight, I was going halfway down the line, as you saw, shaking hands. And a veteran stopped me, he had tears in his eyes. And I said, what's the matter? He said, you guys are the first guys that have ever thanked me since 1946. I fell apart. And I said, well, it's long overdue, but please accept our deepest appreciation for what you did.
And after another quick bus ride, we've arrived at the final stop of the tour for the 82 Eastern Iowa Honor Flight veterans with us today. This is the Air Force Memorial, and we're standing in the middle of three huge curved spires, which must reach up several hundred feet into the air. And off to the side of the Air Force Memorial is a large wall, a black granite wall with some inscriptions, Medal of Honor recipients on this wall. And here's an inscription that jumps out at me. This is from a letter of a World War II veteran who was killed in action. This is a letter that he wrote to his parents. As I prepare for this mission, I'm a bit homesick. Mother and Dad, you are very close to me, and I long so to talk to you. America has asked much of our generation, but I'm glad to give her all I have because she has given me so much. Sergeant Arnold Rahe, U.S. Army Air Forces, World War II, killed in action over France, from a letter to his parents.
We return to Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport after a short nighttime tour of downtown D.C. That involves, again, running red lights and, in one case, driving towards oncoming traffic, all done safely through the police escort in SUVs, lights flashing. After getting settled back on the Charter 737...
When you guys were in the military, you had a lot of different calls. You had sick call, you had pay call, you had reveille. What was your favorite type of call? Does mail call ring a bell? Mail call, guys. Your mail is coming.
Unbeknownst to them, family and friends at home had written letters to them with their thoughts and thanks. And the plane gets quieter as those letters are read.
You have to open it up and find out.
And it's not long before we're back at the Eastern Iowa Airport outside of Cedar Rapids. As they emerge from the ramp and enter the lobby, veterans are greeted by hundreds of people cheering, TV cameras, an honor guard with flags, several people dressed in period military uniforms from bygone days. It's like a small parade route snaking through the lobby. People are reaching out to congratulate the veterans with handshakes. They thank them for their service, and the live musical backdrop, courtesy of the New Horizons Band from Cedar Rapids.
We want to thank George Rickey and the other volunteers that made the Eastern Iowa Honor Flight happen and for accommodating Iowa Public Radio and the assistance before, during, and after the flight. Thanks to the Guardians and to the families of the veterans for their sacrifices during times of uncertainty. Most of all, of course, thanks to the veterans themselves for their many sacrifices. This special edition of River to River was produced by Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Drop us a line. Let us know what you thought of this or any other program. Our email is rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Welcome home.